Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and tonight we got an always special episode. So Colin is here with me in sunny Colorado, warm Colorado actually, and we've just spent the past 3 days hunting mule deer out on the Eastern Plains. So we're going to give you a rundown of it and kind of talk you through our weekend of hunting adventures. They are, I would say, pretty exceptional, with a good ending. So, pretty stoked about that. So, without further ado, I'll kick it off here. Colin, you want to remind everybody what you do?
Hey, everybody. This is Colin. And I'm here visiting Justin in Colorado. I'm the community manager. I'm based out of Oregon, but decided to take a little trip and hopefully shoot some mule deer, which, you know, you'll find out what happens at the end. But, yeah, happy to be here. It was a good week.
Yeah, so for all those who've been following, you know, I moved out to Colorado here in the summer and have really been trying to figure out the hunting out here. So really tried to get a good idea of the first draw or the primary draw here in Colorado, and didn't really have my feet under me. So Colin called me actually the night before the deadline for the secondary draw and was like, hey, should we put in for some secondary draws in Colorado? And for those that don't know the secondary draws, so after you have the primary draws, you have the leftover tags, they push those out at a specified date, and then you have a certain amount of time to put in for those secondary draws, which they'll draw again, and then you receive notification if you drew that tag. So I told him, my elk plans, which if you guys roll back a few episodes to actually the episode title is Elk Make the Plan, you can hear Ben and my experience doing a deep, high, and intense elk hunt here in Colorado for archery, but I wanted to put some balance to that because I spent some time up in Wyoming doing antelope hunt and then also a little elk hunting up there, and then now back down in Colorado. So as I looked at the tags, I really wanted to diversify and try to get as many tags as I could for as many opportunities. And so when Colin and I discussed what we wanted to do, I was like, let's look at the deer tags. So I didn't know much about the mountains because I hadn't really been there, so I didn't know what zones were good, all that. So I was in the early season out in eastern Colorado doing some hunting, archery hunting for antelope, so it gave me the opportunity to kind of scout around some of these areas that were also deer spots. And Colin pointed out one of the zones out in the plains where it was a doe mule deer for rifle. And you get about a week or so in November to fill that tag. So we carved out some time, looked at calendars, realized we could do it, and then put in for the tag, and we both drew the tag. And so we just kind of waited for November to roll around. I don't know, any special prep, anything you thought about beforehand?
No, I don't even think I really e-scouted much. I was kind of relying on Justin for it. But in fact, I kept having to go back and look at the email receipt I got for the tag just to make sure which unit I got. But no, there wasn't anything special for the prep. I think I expected it to be a little bit colder. Looking into kind of the weather a little bit. But I've come out here to Colorado before to hunt with my cousin, and it's always been, you know, upper 20s, low 30s in the morning, and maybe it'll get up to mid 50s during the day. So it's kind of what I was expecting.
And you guys weren't really hunting up at elevation either, too.
6,000 feet, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we were probably at four to five where we were. So just a warm year so far.
Yep. So I packed a lot of wool socks and heavy socks and ended up not needing them. Yeah, that's pretty much the only preparation I did for it.
I think prep-wise for me, I mean, like I mentioned, I was out for antelope hunt. I did do a bit of e-scouting on Onyx. And what you run into in the Eastern Plains is the majority of those zones, the land within those zones are primarily private land. So even Colorado Parks and Wildlife recommend – sorry, yeah, Colorado Wildlife and Parks. There you go. Colorado Wildlife and Parks.
Parks and Wildlife.
Is it Parks and Wildlife?
Yeah, CBW.
I thought it was CWP.
No, CBW.
CBW. So Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Recommend that you get owner permission from whatever spot you're going to go before you even apply for the tags. You know, there's multiple opportunities in the Eastern Plains for mule deer. This year they put out a lot of these X tags, which give you the ability to hunt multiple seasons. So archery, muzzleloader, your plains rifle season, and then a late plains rifle season for whitetail. They're really tackling the whitetail in some of those agricultural areas out in the east. So I think the general populace is not too happy about it. So interesting, same thing you see up in Wyoming. People are just like whitetail everywhere. I mean, we were elk hunting last week up in Wyoming, and someplace I never thought I would see whitetail deer. We were up, you know, we'd crossed a creek and we're climbed up 1,000 feet, and we're up at 6,000 feet on the side of a mountain, basically, and in these little gullies and hills, we're bumping, you know, two separate groups of like six whitetail deer. And it was insane. I think that's like mule deer country to me, not necessarily whitetail country. So you can see the population's grown. And even in that area up in Wyoming, they have unlimited whitetail doe tags, and you can go pick them up for like $34. So, which is pretty insane. That's the out of state. I couldn't even imagine what the in state rate is. It's probably like $10 or $15, if that. But to sort of shift back around to Colorado, so there's a lot of opportunity in the Eastern Plains. It is flat, but I will say it's not as flat as you would think it is.
No, it's not like the top of a table. It's not Nebraska flat.
No.
Driven through Nebraska, you can see for miles from the highway.
I mean, there's little dips and gullies. There's some ridges. There's all this stuff. You know, you have parts of the Eastern Plains. And when I say Eastern Plains, or eastern part of Colorado, the plains, it's a... it's basically I-25 east to Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, like kind of that area. That's how CPW divides it up. CWP? No, CPW. Keep messing myself up. That's how they divide it up. So generally, I mean, they have a plains elk tag. They have a plains bear tag. They have, you know, whitetail only tags. They've got mule deer only tags. We had, it's just... defines it as deer, antlerless deer, so that constitutes both mule deer and whitetail deer, doe, and the classification for antlers is anything under 5 inches. which, I mean, it's just like kind of something visible, but important to know, especially to stay on top of regulations. But thinking about the environment out here, like, kind of dry, a lot of farmland, so you're getting deer are really centered around two primary areas, like one where they have access to food, and so that could be your agriculture land, and two where they have access to water, because it's plains, there's a lot of dry creek beds, but there's a lot of cattle gear irrigation ponds, there's a lot of solar powered water pumps pumping into troughs, and so deer are all attracted to those types of places, which is kind of what we targeted when we were out and about. I was looking for some differences in terrain. So, you know, going into Onyx and you're looking at the topography maps, and when you see, you know, the squiggles of an elevation change and a bunch of little tight lines together, that's a good indication that there's some good slope there, and some maybe some bluffs or some gullies with some water at the bottom, or, you know, somewhere in a creek bottom or something like that. So really, that's kind of where my mind was when I kind of chose where we were going to go. And like I said, there was a limited amount of public land, so like, you can't just go out and be like, all right, we're going to do this. So I told Colin, I said, our plan is to kind of, you know, each day we'll go check out two or three spots, and we'll identify which ones we want to see, and we'll just go hike into it and kind of get a good lay of the land. And so that was our plan. Like, nothing more complex than that. Anything to add with travel out here or getting here?
No, it was pretty easy to get here. It was a quick flight and all that. But, no, I mean, as far as the logistics were, it was pretty easy.
Yeah, it was good. I did think it a good opportunity to bring my daughter. She's 9, so I wanted to start getting her more into hunting. And so we went the evening before we planned to go out. We went to the store, and, you know, she got new hiking boots. She got a new backpack and a water reservoir, and we picked out snacks. And I'm trying to think what other exciting things happened that day. I think that's pretty much it. Like, I tried to get her like really into it, and I was thinking about it. I was like, we're going to be out there. You know, the spot we're going is 2 hours away from the house. So it's not a big deal if she was like, I'm done, I'm ready to go home, because I honestly want to keep it. That's sort of the point of when she's done, I don't want to push her too hard, because then she won't be interested to come back out. So I feel like 2 hours was a pretty safe distance, whereas like, if she was completely done, you know, Colin and I could come back here and drop her off and then easily make it back out there for like an evening sit or something like that. But luckily enough, we didn't have to do that. She was pretty gung-ho throughout the whole entire thing. I think all in all, the first day we did almost 10 miles worth of walking.
Yeah, and I think it was a little bit over 9, almost 9.5.
Yeah, and she was with us the whole time. I did bring, I have an old like Ruger 10/22. I took the magazine out of it and kept it in my pocket in case you saw a small game or something. And she carried that, and it was really a good lesson, you know, on gun control, gun safety. We practiced everything, crossing fences, you know, carrying the gun, treating it like it's loaded. We hit all the highlights, and it really gave me a good sense and a good judgment point to see sort of where she was at in her maturity level when it comes to firearms, so that I can kind of judge whether it's she needs more time before she's introduced to them, or if she's ready to start kind of getting more into the shooting, and if she's able to understand the respect that you have to give a gun when you carry it. But outside of that, so the first day we headed out to pretty much the closest piece of public land in that zone to my house. I think that's how I picked it.
Yeah.
And I found like a little gully in there, what looked like a little gully, and we just set out for that spot. And or no, sorry. The first spot was a ridgeline, not even a gully. It was a ridgeline where I saw a topography change. Basically, the ridge kind of ran east to west, and then you had kind of some fingers that extended down drainage down to the south out of that ridge. And then on the north, there were a couple areas where there was a creek bottom, which I actually thought was pretty deep and could hold water. There was a pond. There were a couple irrigation wells for cattle. So it was good. This is a piece of state land. So state land you can only really access from the access points. So you have to go to the parking lot, park, and walk in. So the ridge line, what was probably...
I think we did about 3 miles round trip that first area.
I think that first one, yeah. So it was about a mile and a half to the actual ridge we wanted to get to. And we'd gotten, as we were pushing towards the ridge, we hit a fence line. And on the fence line as we were crossing, I noticed a good spot for us to cross was also a good spot for the deer to cross, because there are like deer hair on the barbed wire a little bit, you know, just a buildup over time. So that was neat to kind of catch and see that, oh yeah, my head's in the right spot. Like, we're looking in the right area, like the animals are crossing here. And then we pushed that ridge line. I don't know if it was a bird, or it could have been a rabbit or a prairie dog or something, but I saw movement going down this ridge, and it kind of made me excited. Then we pushed up to the ridge and like worked all the little crevices and stuff, and like really didn't find much in that first spot. It was definitely a lot flatter than I thought it was, and the definition in the creek bottom wasn't there where I thought it could be. So, I don't know. What are your thoughts on the first spot?
Yeah, the first spot wasn't bad. we saw some deer sign around there, like you were saying, on the fence with the tufts of fur hanging off. We definitely saw some tracks. We saw some scat. I don't think it was a bad spot. It was around a few farms. You know, the sheep were getting herded out across the street from us. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that could have had something to do with it, and maybe we just weren't there at the right time. But the bluff that we, the ridge that we went to, wasn't that unlike the ridge that we went to the last day where we actually were successful. I mean, the last one was a little bit bigger, but it wasn't too much of a difference. It was facing the same way. It was about the same height from the valley, from the floor of the below it. So I don't think it was a bad spot.
I think too, you never really know what kind of pressure an area gets too. Like, it could have, we saw a sign of where animals bedded down and all this other stuff, and it could have been antelope, it could have been deer, it could have been
a multitude. Ooh.
It could have been antelope, it could have been deer, it could have been a multitude of things, but you know, you don't really know who was there the evening before or the day before, or like whatever, especially when it comes to these small patches of public land like that. Like, somebody could easily come out just like we did and walk it in a couple hours and then move on to the next one, which is exactly what we did. So we then moved from that spot to another. So that piece was state land. I identified some other property that was part of the Pawnee National Grassland, which was cool because I never hunted a grassland. Very similar rules and concepts to the national forest, but it being a grassland instead. So we set out for this place. It was probably 9 miles away. It took us like 15, 20 minutes to get there, driving down the dirt roads. And we get there, and at the intersection to kind of the middle of the property, truck stops. You can tell like the guy at the adjacent stop sign is a hunter. And so I give him a wave, and I'm like, hey man, how's it going? You know, he awkwardly rolls down his window and starts chatting with me. I was like, having any luck? And he's like, actually, I'm having no luck. And I was like, okay, well, that's a bummer. I was like, what are you hunting for? He's like, jackrabbits. But we didn't find any. And like at that moment, his dog like pokes its head up around his shoulder. And I was like, oh, okay, so cool. And I was like, Colin reached around and was like, or leaned over and was like, hey, did you see any deer? And the guy's like, oh, they're pretty shy around here, which I've learned to take that with a grain of salt depending on how coveted a person finds that spot. I think this spot drew my attention a little more because it had even more defined kind of gully, creek bottom.
Yeah, I would almost call them canyons, like small canyons.
Small canyons. There was a reservoir there, which we thought may hold water. In turn, we learned it did. So we got to the property line, Weren't sure how far we could drive in because there's the grassland has some high on and off highway vehicle roads. You just got to check the maps on the Forestry Service website to see where you can and can't drive if you have an on-highway vehicle or an off-highway vehicle. So we weren't sure about that, so we just parked the car and just walked it down and got down to the bottom of the reservoir, and there was definitely water in there, so that's a good sign. So now we're looking at an area that's pretty desolate, having a good water source, which is good. On our walk down, we noticed three herds of antelope at different points, which is pretty promising because that means a good spot for next year for either archery or to put in for antelope tags. So then we kind of like our plan was we really played on the wind to kind of walk with the wind at our back, walking.
No, we wanted it in our face.
We wanted it in our face. But we had to kind of loop around to get where we want, like basically like a big loop in order to skirt the south side of the canyon to work our way to the east side of the canyon to then work our way back to the west side with the wind facing us to get a good visibility, if that makes sense. So it's like a very roundabout way to get down into the canyon. Then it kind of like as we're heading east, there were these fingers that were extending southward, which we would get to the edge and then kind of glass up and down each side. And I think the elevation change from the top to the bottom of those was probably only like 50 feet.
Yeah, 50-75 feet maybe.
Yeah, so not anything crazy, but a lot of good brush. There were some live oaks back there, so it was good habitat, and like we were seeing deer sign.
Yeah, lots of tracks.
Lots of tracks down in the actual canyon, so that was pretty promising. We basically pushed all the way back to the back of the property, which was, that was about 2 miles from where the car was parked?
Yeah, I think that ended up being another, like, 3 mile.
Yeah, that was another 3 mile loop, because I think that put us...
Yeah. We were at 7 when we left there, but then remember we went over to the other side. That windbreak.
Yep. Yep. And then, yeah, so we did that. We worked our way back up the canyon, and really, like, nothing too eventful. We're just able to work that canyon really well and continue to see sign. I would probably go back there again. We did find another access point that was closer to the canyon. I think we walked in just to get to where the beginning in the canyon was. We probably walked in
a mile and a half.
A mile. You think a mile and a half, or maybe a mile? A mile. Yeah. And then the other part was probably like half a mile, maybe, from where that little corner parking lot was. So if I ever go back again to hunt antelope, I'll definitely go in from that other way, depending on the wind, of course. But seemed like a pretty promising spot for both antelope and some mule deer. Like I said, you never know what pressure it gets. So then we were kind of... Oh, we saw across the road, which was also still on the National Grassland land, there was a big windbreak, and it was just like this big kind of...
Yeah, it was like a semicircle.
Yeah.
Octagon, half octagon.
Which normally you see those when there's like structures or something on the south side of them, because it blocks the north wind and the snow and all that other stuff. But there wasn't really any... There were no structures.
No, there was nothing there.
No structures over there, no infrastructure, nothing. So I told Colin, I was like, there's nothing else really out here, so let's just go take that. And we kind of did like a... I wouldn't call it a deer drive, but I walked down one side and Colin walked down the other, and we just like saw what we could spook up.
Yeah, so maybe something would jump out.
Literally nothing.
No.
Zero deer, zero sign, just a
possible grouse. Maybe it was a grouse that spooked up, but
I didn't
get a good enough look at it.
Yeah, I never saw anything, so I couldn't tell you. But then from there, we had to take a lunch break time. Like Zoe was definitely, she was at her wit's end. So we cruised into town, local town there, Sterling, and had pretty good lunch, I'd say. And then we talked over another plan and identified a couple other spaces. And one of those spaces that we identified It was like north of Sterling. We got out there and it was like flat, like no contour whatsoever. So at that point, we didn't even get out of the car.
Yeah, we just took one look and said, yeah, it's not going
to
work.
So then we worked our way to an additional piece of property, which I was really confident about because it was a piece of land that was national grassland, and it had what looked like a water source. It had springs, and it had some spots labeled the Indian caves, which yeah. I think was pretty cool. So we never really figured out why they were called Indian caves, and we did see a couple things that looked like caves, but never we didn't go in them, obviously, but still some curious landmarks on the map. But we got out there, and you know, at the roadway sign, so there was a two track going into this piece of property, and they have like a vertical sign that tells you what's allowed on the track and what's not, and we couldn't really discern if an on-highway vehicle like my car was allowed back in there or not. So we were also kind of out of steam because we'd racked up almost 10 miles at that point and had lunch and all that. So we were kind of more just visually scouting access and kind of trying to understand the property. And the bluffs that we wanted to go to were probably, 3 miles from?
Yeah, easily. Two to 3 miles back.
Yeah, from the gate. So we didn't have it in us, and I'll give it, Zoe was a trooper the entire time. She did not have it in her, and I wasn't going to push her to try to hike back there and hike back, or hike there and hike back. So we kind of tabled that property, and then there was three other properties that we wanted to look at that we kind of did drive-bys. We found one had a dry creek bottom that looked kind of promising, but we really hung on to the notion that we were going to revisit those bluffs. And I think that was kind of our main strategy because I saw the contour and the texture, and based on where I've hunted mule deer before, it just it matched up perfect. I was like, that is great mule deer country. So we tabled it, and that was our first day on Friday, and we came back not early. We came back a little early, and basically just got ready for the next day. So did some family stuff around, and then we decided, so one of the reservoirs here locally has got some permanent blinds that they set up, and you can go out and do duck and geese hunting. And so I opted to then take Zoe again, and then also this time take my 18-month-old son, Remy, out with us so that he could hang out and kind of see how he would do in the hunting environment. But that was a pretty successful day. You want to talk through that a little bit?
Yeah, it was. They had a good setup out there because it was the dry area behind a dam, which basically makes up this reservoir, and it was a fair walk out there. It's probably a mile walk to get out to the blinds. Mm-hmm. But basically you just sign up and you put your name on a little sheet and put it in the slot where there's one open and then walk out there.
The cool thing was that you could see the people that had checked out of the blinds. So it's all set up on a reservation system. So we went out in the afternoon, expecting the reservations to be done with, or you're not done with, but people to be out of the blinds and already closed out. So when you check out, you have to put a ticket in there and you put what you harvested. And so we could see the different blinds and see what people had harvested in those blinds.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we picked our location off of, was where people got the most. So there was one cluster of about four or five blinds where whoever was there before got about four to five geese apiece. So that's where we picked. Walked out there. Turned out the blind we wanted to go to was in a terrible spot. There was construction going on in front of it. They were digging up a trench or something.
Which it was just the equipment part there.
It was the equipment there, yeah. But it also didn't have a great landing zone, if something was coming from over the dam, it didn't look like anything would come down immediately and try to land in front of us. So we opted to actually switch our spot and go back to one of the blinds farther back. So we set up there. It was pretty hot out. We had the sun beating down on us for a good couple hours. But we just kind of waited. And then almost like clockwork, I kept telling Justin that the golden hour is coming an hour before sunset.
Oh, and Zoe's like, when are the geese going to be here? Because we kept also having, there were a lot of gulls and cormorants that would fly off the lake. And, you know, your first, like, hour out there, you're like, is that a goose? Is that a duck? Is that a goose? But yeah. It's like, oh, no, it's a gull. And after a while, we, like, figured out the difference between them. But, man, it's hard to explain that to a 9-year-old of, like, nope, that's not what we're looking for. And eventually, like, she got the concept, too.
But almost pretty much like clockwork, an hour before sunset, the first group of geese fly over. It was probably like, what, four or five of them?
Yep.
Fly over, did a couple calls, and I'm not an expert goose caller by any means, so I just gave it a couple blasts, and I think they turned based on the calls. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were doing that originally, but they turned towards us, but the people in the blind, a few yards away, a couple hundred yards away, they shot up and took one down, and then the other three flew off. So good on them, but we knew that they were flying around. And for the next hour, it was a steady stream of very large flocks flying overhead, way too high for us to take reasonable shots at. But we had a couple flocks, smaller ones, that were lower, and we took some shots at them, didn't get anything down. Still may have been too high. But and then a couple ducks flew by too, but the ducks weren't. Yeah, it wasn't going to happen for us. It was mostly geese that we were looking for.
Yeah, I think there were, what, four total groups of hunters out there in the different blinds. And it's like, it was dispersed really well kind of throughout. So you weren't, like, shooting into each other at all, really. But it was cool because you'd see, like, oh, there's a flock flying that way. And you'd, like, wait. You're like, are they going to shoot? And you hear, like, bow, bow. And then they'd shoot. So it was cool to see that. It was a good day all around. We had like a little spread of geese decoys we put out. Nice little V pattern. Pretty good. I honestly think that those four that Colin honked at were going to come towards us. I think they turned just straight towards us, and then those other guys definitely got the jump on them. So if you guys are listening out there, you're welcome. Because they wouldn't have flown over your blind otherwise.
Enjoy your one goose.
Yeah, which was more goose than we got.
We'll enjoy our zero geese.
Yeah, so unsuccessful day, but cool to know about that program because, I mean, it's pretty easy. It's literally 20 minutes from my house to get up there. And I will say both kids, although they wanted a little more entertainment because I told them they could only take a notepad and some crayons out there. And they both did good, entertained each other playing in the dirt in the blind, but did really well. And I think I would use that as another avenue to take them out too. I was very impressed. Remy, my youngest, was like not. We had earmuffs for both of them, and he was not even fazed by the shotgun blast. So
yeah,
that was pretty. Was pretty stoked about that. So
at Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
And then our plan was get up early the next day and try to get out there to that property with enough time to hike in and get to that back bluff sort of at sunrise or at legal shooting light, somewhere in between legal shooting light and sunrise, so that we could really just catch the deer moving really well. And so we woke up early the next morning, like really early, because we were up really late, and woke up early and got on the road. And just so happened that it was also daylight savings time. So
I had looked at my weather app the night before, and it still said sunrise was at 7:30. And I said, all right, cool. It's at 7:30. Didn't really think much of it that was the same time as the day before. Just kind of went with it. So that's what we were planning our timeline off of, just kind of worked back from that. 2 hours to get out means we need to leave at, well, that's 7:30 sunrise, so we want to be there at 7. 2 hours out for a drive, it means we need to leave by 5, which means we need to be up by 4. So that's kind of the way we did the math. But then realized that the app did not update itself for daylight savings time. And we were actually leaving an hour later than we wanted to based on the time of the sunrise. So that was kind of a downer, just being unprepared and not thinking about that and kind of getting in. I kind of got in my own head a little bit that maybe this is already down the drain before we even get out there.
And I told Colin, everything happens for a reason, Colin.
Yep.
Yeah, and did. Also, too, we got to looking, and so we explored the regulations for the on-highway and off-highway vehicles, and we found out the road we were going to go into, you can drive down in an on-highway vehicle. So you can only drive partially down, but we literally shaved off probably 2 miles, I would say.
Oh, yeah, easily. That was easily an hour and a half of walking that we shaved off. Yeah.
Yep, and so we got back there. Anyway, we got to the gate and got through the gate and working our way to that property, cruising down the two-track, and I look up behind me, and I notice that there's another truck behind me, like, kind of closing in, and I was like, okay, maybe it's another hunter, like, you know, we're gonna have to do the normal thing, like, hey, what are you hunting first, what are your plans, where do you want to go, all right, like, we kind of divide and conquer the property so that we aren't hunting on top of each other, and then... So I pull over and I stop, and the guy kind of stops on the back driver's side quarter, and then gets out, and we start talking with him.
Yeah, and the first thing he says is that he wants to make sure that we don't go over one of the fences with the padlock, and he points out these trees, and we come to realize that he is one of the ranch managers for the ranch surrounding the area of public land that we were planning on hunting. And he said, yeah, we've had hunters up here before, and the GPS is wrong. He said he started saying that Onyx was wrong. They actually did like a land swap, and what's marked as government land or public land on there is not actually public land. It's actually his land, being the ranch's land. So I think he was trying to be very protective of his property. He said that he's had hunters there before, and they ended up shooting some of his horses, which is just terrible. And we assured him that we're not going to do that. We know what we're looking for. We know the difference between a horse and a deer. We're going to be very respectful of the property lines. We also asked him if there are any deer up there. Originally, he said, no, there aren't any deer up there. But then we kind of warmed up to each other. And he ended up saying, yeah, I've seen deer back there before. And he said, in fact, you guys can go on top of the ridge and just don't go about halfway back. That's kind of the limit where he wants us to go. But go on top of the ridge and you guys can hunt the whole ridge. So it was good. I think we gave him the warm, fuzzy feeling that we were going to be responsible when we kept going.
Yeah, so we parked. After that, he pulled back, turned around, went the other way. And we kept driving down until we got to, like, the water tank, basically the spot where it was marked, one, to stop for no more traffic, and then also he was like, yeah, the best spot to park is down by that water tank. So we did that, and we walked in, and we hit the fence he was talking about, and we crossed it, and we started our way up these bluffs. And I would say probably
a mile in.
A mile in.
Yeah.
And then we hit the bluffs, and how high do you think the bluffs were?
Maybe 100 feet.
Yeah, maybe 100 feet or so. Pretty steep. We found a game trail and worked up the game trail, got up on top of the bluff. Up on top of the bluff, you could literally see down to where our car was a mile away, and you could see like 3 miles past that, maybe 4 miles past that. And then to the south and to the north, it was pretty flat. There was all these like kind of scraggly rock formations that just kind of like popped up out of the grass, which was neat. And then there were shallow divots or shallow troughs where the land kind of dipped a little bit.
Depressions in the land.
Yeah. It wasn't super, super defined, but you could definitely tell that there was a slight elevation change. So we didn't see anything initially when we got up there. We glassed the face of it, so it was a south-facing slope coming in. I didn't really expect anything to be bedded down there, but you never know. Because it would just be kind of in direct sun. In the morning, it was cool. Still like in the 30s to 40s. But it was projected to warm all the way up to like the upper 70s. So, don't really know that you'd see the animals on those slopes directly in the sun, kind of staring into the sun. So, anyway, we worked our way up to the top. We got on top and just started glassing around. And like our strategy was, the wind was coming. We had one particular area we wanted to look at with some trees and what we thought was a spring in it. But we wanted to scout kind of the eastern side of the bluff before we went and checked out that spot, because then that would point us walking into the wind towards that. So that would give us an advantage when it came to the wind. The wind did shift at some point during our morning, and then shifted the other way to where it was actually in favor of us walking in that easterly direction.
Yeah, so as we're walking, we start kind of doing the stopping and glassing every once in a while. Because it's so far out, my thinking was that I don't want to come up on one of those depressions and then come up too fast and then spook a deer out of it. So I stop and glass at this one point, and I see these two little ears poking up over top of a rock, and I turn and whisper over to Justin and say, just like a, hey, Justin, there's a doe over there. And so he's like, okay, where? And I kind of tell him the right direction. He's like, are you sure? And I was like, yep, I saw it move. I know the shape. I saw it move, and it ducked behind those rocks. And he's like, all right, let's go get it. So we walked up. We pointed out some rocks that were just in front of that. We wanted to get to. I think it was a big tree by it too. And we went up there and started glassing again and saw two does that were on top of another mound even further back, about 285 yards. And they were both just feeding there. So we decided to drop our packs and try and move in a little bit closer. That's a little bit too far of a shot for me to take comfortably. Justin said he would be good for that one, but we both wanted to come away with the deer. So we moved up to this smaller, like a younger tree that was about maybe 20 yards, 15 to 20 yards to our left, and just kind of sat there and watched these deer for a little bit more before we decided where to go to next.
And then all of a sudden, Colin's like, hey man, there's this big doe like walking towards us. And I was like, what do you mean big doe? And so I kind of like pull my glass up, and he's like, wait a minute, that's not a big doe. That's a giant buck, like just slowly sauntering towards us. And it was probably like 100 yards away. And within the course of like probably a minute, he had closed the distance, still coming not straight at us, but we had dropped our packs probably 15, 20 yards off to our right. And he was basically making like a beeline towards those packs, which was really interesting. So we just watched him, and he just kind of had his head not down, but his head kind of like, straight. And you could see his antlers. He was good 4x4, maybe 5x5 with some good brow tines. And he was just cruising along. And he actually got so close to us that Colin was like, hey, man, you should, like, grab your rifle. And I was like, I can't. It's, like, sitting on the ground. Because the thought being not to shoot him out of, you know, a hunting aspect, but because he was starting to get closer, and if we spooked him and he became super threatened by us, like, who knows, you know? You never know if he's going to charge or whatever. I'm not saying that that's a common thing that happens, but it just comes to your mind when you're, like, within that proximity to kind of a larger game animal.
Yeah, he was a big deer.
Probably, that is the biggest mule deer I think I've seen.
Yeah, me too. That's probably the biggest of any deer I've ever seen, actually. But he, I mean, he was very close, I mean, 10 to 20 yards away, right next to our packs. We have it on a video about how close he got to us.
Yep. And we'll be putting out the whole hunting video soon.
And he had strand of barbed wire strung across his antlers too. So that was another added element to it. He kind of got to choose your own weapon vibe going on for him, but he was so close that we could have easily spooked him and he would have decided to charge instead of run. But Justin did a little tisk tisk at him and he perked up and then just bolted. Actually back in the direction of the does that we were watching, but then he cut across right in the middle and ended up not spooking them, thankfully. And he kind of went off to the side.
Yeah, I was really concerned when he started running back that way. Because my ultimate strategy was, like, as he was walking towards us, he was moving well until he got almost to our side. And then he started to really slow down and he started to stop. And I don't know if he was starting to get a good wind of us.
Well, he turned towards us, too. Yeah. He would have walked right past us, but pretty much as soon as he got to our... Maybe he was following our scent for some reason. Yeah. Because he got to our packs and then turned towards us.
Yep.
And that's when you started doing the tisk tisk, because otherwise he would have walked right past us and would have been no issue.
Yep. What I wanted him to do was to keep going past us and then kind of spook him so he ran off behind us versus, like, running back towards the doe and then potentially, like, pulling them with him as he went. Which, you know, I've seen happen several times. So luckily I was super thankful when that didn't happen and he kind of, like Colin said, took that slant route. But then you look at it, for our next step, we really then focused back on that doe and we had that 280 yards between us. And
I think we were about 250 now, right? We closed a little bit of the distance.
We were still 280 cause we just shifted to the north. So we were still at the same distance east to west. But there were, like, small outcrops of rocks, like I mentioned earlier. So we had to work our way sort of walking across small bits of cactus, dry grass, and then, like, embedded rock in the dirt, like large rocks. So our strategy was to just kind of walk on the rocks and be as quiet as we could, not really crunch the grass or crunch the cactus, and then try to keep some sort of structure or object between us, which was really hard to do. Like, you could belly crawl, but it wouldn't be fun because there was a ton of cactus.
Cactus spines in you.
Yeah. So we just had to kind of try to stay as low as we could. And then we worked our way, stopping and glassing, because that deer was just very, like, whimsical. It wasn't really paying attention to us. It was just kind of there.
And by this point, one of them at least had sat down.
Embedded,
and then the other one we weren't quite sure of because it went over the rocks.
So then we get to a point now where we're at, what were we, 120, 150, 140.
Yeah, I think the 140. Final spot was at 140.
Yeah, we were at 140, and so I told Colin, you know, take a look in your glass, like, tell me what you see and what you think and, like, what you feel. And
yeah, I basically only saw the ears and the top of its head. There was probably more that was exposed behind the grass, but that wasn't a shot that I was willing to take just because I couldn't see the whole shape. Also, it was still 140 yards trying to hit a head. You know, that could be – there's a lot of room for error with that.
Yeah. So – I kind of got it in my mind that the doe that we had in view was sitting in some grass, some tall grass, to the south of this like small rock cropping, which we'd seen the other doe go behind. So we were like, oh, okay, well, that doe never emerged. So in my mind, I was like, I got to work around this rock cropping to try to get a view of this other doe. And so I told Colin, I was like, just sit here, keep your glass on that deer, because if I spook anything else, that deer is going to stand up and you'll have a shot. So that was kind of the plan. And I worked wide to the left, so to the north, really, really wide, because I wanted, one, to stay out of his shooting lane, but two, I was kind of like following the outcrops of rocks. And as I bounced, you know, in probably 20-yard increments, rock to rock, I was still trying to keep separation between me and the deer that he was watching, because I wanted to find another deer before he also shot. And I was following the same sort of procedures. Like, I'd go to a rock, I'd like kind of stay low, then I'd go to my knees, then I'd glass over whatever ridge I could see or gully, and then I would just kind of keep doing that. And by the third one, I spotted the property fence line, and on the property fence line, just forward of it, between me and the fence, I saw a doe bedded down. There were three of them, and so I was like, all right, cool. So then I bounced a little bit closer, and I think I was 100 yards from where that deer was. Where the rock crop I set up on, there were like no stable rocks. Every rock moved, so I was trying to get my bipod adjusted. And then at this point, the doe sees me. One of the does sees me, so she's up on all fours. And I'm like, all right, cool, perfect. So there's another smaller rock cropping just ahead of me by like 10, maybe 5 yards. And so I kind of slink up to it. I can't crawl because of the cactus, which is what I want to do. And I slink up to it, and I get up there, and I'm able to kind of get a stable rest on it. And about the time that I'm about to put the crosshair, I'm looking through the crosshair, and I've got it on her center mass. What I thought was a doe next to her stands up, and it's a yearling. And I won't shoot doe that have a yearling. It's not really, you know, I've seen people do it. It's whatever you do it. It's my personal choice. I don't want to do it. So then I move over to the next pair, which is another doe and yearling. And then I move to the next pair. And by that point, they've kind of like, I'm not moving physically, I'm just moving my glass, my optic on my rifle. So then as I have it on the third pair, who is actually just two lone doe, or paired doe, whatever you want to call them, they're two grown doe, that kind of group of six spooks. And so they jump over the fence and they start kind of up the adjacent hillside. Well, as that's going on, I look over to my right to where the deer that we had seen earlier, and so I can't see the original deer that Colin had seen. I can only assume that it spooked with the others, but I see another doe and another yearling bedded down nearby, and I just like, I'm not going to take that shot either, so I just wait. So I'm just kind of there like on my knees just watching these deer run away, see if they stop, kind of watching what they're doing. They get out to 500 yards. Like at that point, I'm like, all right, time's up, I'm done. And then I hear pow, and that's when I look back and Colin like gives me two thumbs up. I was like super pumped for him.
Yeah, so I didn't really know what Justin was seeing when he went over there. I could only assume that he could see a part of the doe that we were tracking, or the other doe, but I didn't know that there were all those other ones over there. But I did see the one that I was looking at spook, and I expected it to spook and stand up and be at the alert in the same spot, but instead it spooked and ran 10 yards in the opposite direction. And at that point, I didn't really have a clear shooting lane anymore. There were a couple rocks in front of me. So I scurried up to the next group of rocks about 10 yards in front of me, maybe less, and set up there. It was actually a pretty nice shooting position, too. I was fortunate with the rock formation. But my deer kept running a little bit. It's like doing its little trot, and I put it back in my scope. And the whole time, I saw its butt facing towards me. I didn't really see any more of the body, but then it stopped and quartered a little bit so that its left back leg was closest to me. And at that point, I didn't even think about it. I put the crosshairs right on the bottom of its neck and pulled the trigger. Probably the cleanest shot I've ever taken. I've shot that rifle at the range, and this was by far the smoothest, cleanest, no rough edges around the shot that I've ever taken.
What did you, at that point, did you know what the distance was?
Not at that point. I felt pretty good about it. I thought that since we were at 140, it couldn't have gone that far.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt pretty good about it based on how much of the neck I could see. And I had the neck and the front shoulder pretty much in line. So I knew that if I aimed for the bottom of the neck, bottom half of the neck, that I would hit somewhere along that line, which I was comfortable with because I would definitely put it down.
Okay.
But no, I didn't know the exact distance.
I just kind of wanted to get at like why you made the shot at the base of the neck was just to, that way if it did drop, it would drop in it somewhere you knew was like you had a big vital area despite it being like quartering away from you.
Right. I mean, that's a vital area in the neck. It's if it hits in the neck, it might not drop right away, but it's going to drop.
Yeah.
But I went for my follow-up sight picture, and it was down on the ground, legs flailing on the ground. So I knew it was a good hit.
So now super stoked. So we go and the old adage is the work doesn't really start until the animal's down, because now the temperature's rising. We're expecting 70s, and we've got this animal we have to basically quarter. Can't carry it out. Can't drag it out. So we just walk through quartering it and get it done as quickly as we can.
Yeah, pretty much. I did end up measuring the shot just based on waypoint to waypoint from Onyx, and it was 240. So it ended up being a 240-yard shot.
Nice.
And it went right through just behind the left shoulder, through one of the lungs, and then out almost dead center in its chest.
I think it was great.
I thought it was a clean shot.
Great deer. And it was your first deer?
That was my first deer. Yeah.
Super excited about that. Glad I got to be there for that moment and like sharing that. It's always fun to see. I too shot. Oh, so you need to talk about the deer.
What, it being a button buck?
Yeah.
So it ended up being a button buck, which still counts as antlerless. But like we were saying before, it's less than 5 inches. But I was happy with it.
Yeah.
It was a good first deer.
My first deer was also a button buck. Not at all a similar scenario. So
yeah,
it was pretty well earned, though. Well earned. We packed it out. We actually, on the way out, saw another herd.
Well, we saw a 3x3 buck, another 3x3.
Oh, yeah, while we were cleaning that deer.
While we were dressing down this deer, we saw another buck wander within probably 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were walking out, and there was another herd just on the other side of the fence of the private land that we were bordering.
In which I got close, and I was kind of set up about 100 yards from the fence watching them. Colin was back a couple hundred yards behind me, and they were working their way towards me, and I was hoping they were going to cross the fence onto the public land, but something spooked them to the north, and they got real spooky, and then they just kind of like worked to another ridge line, and then worked down on top to another ridge line. They just kind of kept going, and then even as we were hiking out, you can still see like their little silhouettes on the ridge line, like looking down on this big open space where we were packing out.
It was like a band of marauders lined up on the Wild West hills back in like an old western. So they were just like lined up against the sky on this butte, just looking over the plains, watching us walk.
So yeah, it was kind of cool. That was cool. So then we get back and get everything iced down and get back here and do the processing. Like that was kind of it. You want to talk a little bit about the CWD?
Yeah. So the area that the unit that we took the deer in is not a mandatory CWD testing area, but I'm interested in the process and an advocate for the testing of it. So I took it to the check station today and checked it in. It was a $25 fee if you're not in a mandatory testing area, but I was happy to pay that because I want to make sure the meat's good too. It's like that. We were thinking about it, and we were talking about it a lot in the car, that there aren't any known cases of CWD transmission to humans, but no one wants to be the first. So I'd rather be safe than sorry. But the check-in process was pretty neat. Just a line right out front. A lot of people there with some people having their heads in their bags. Some people have them just out on the ground. In fact, there was a group behind me who had like three or four deer and elk heads just lying on the ground. But you fill out all this info on a piece of paper and check it in, and then they go and verify the position, the latitude and longitude where you took it. And then you just kind of get all this info about what to expect. It should be about 3 weeks, and you'll get your results back. And it was pretty painless. You just had to wait in line, really, but they knew what they were doing. It wasn't like you guys showed up and they were not expecting it. They were out there ready to go. So, yeah, it was pretty good. It was nicely done.
Nice. And that was kind of it. That was our adventure. I mean, I did not end up filling my tag, and that tag is over with tomorrow. But I'm sitting on a couple whitetail tags, and pretty excited about that. So I'll get back out on the plains. Still got my Wyoming elk tag. Probably go take another poke at it in December, and just still rolling strong. Now I got a new goose spot. Got a little bit of honey hole for some mule deer for next year, and pretty excited. Colin got his first deer. So
yeah,
I don't know. Too. Last thoughts for you?
I think we had a couple hot tips we discussed. One is always expect that there are deer on the other side of the area you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the one.
It's not as flat as it looks.
Oh, it's never as flat as it looks.
Deer can hide behind a bush.
Yep.
Or tall grass, yeah. And I don't know. I think the rut may have started. I think it may be later.
Yeah, I think the rut was going on because there were a couple herds with bucks definitely in charge. And then we saw those two kind of wanderers, satellites walking around.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, there was another one too. But now I just lost it.
we'll think about it. So
yeah.
We're going to post a video on Adventures for Food on the YouTube. So you'll see that as an Adventures for Food. Adventures for Food, Colorado Mule Deer. So that'll be the whole experience there. Then we're going to wait till the meat comes back so we can cook some of that and give you a little cool recipe with that as well. And then Colin's going to do an adventure for food, so you can hear a little more in-depth about the story of sort of him taking the deer. So check that out on the same channel. And then, that's the excitingness we kind of have to share from this past weekend mule deer hunting in Colorado, which is super fun. So did you remember what it was?
No.
Okay, that's fine. I will say to everyone out there, thanks for listening. Make sure that you're following us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, wherever. We're probably there. Make sure you're following us. Stay up to date with what we're doing. The crew's constantly doing things. We have lots of plans coming out spring 2022. Lots of educational opportunities. Lots of stuff to be more interactive. Really stoked. COVID seems on the decline. So we're kind of out and about, and we're planning some big events to do more engaging and more teaching and more hunting and fishing with each other so we can create some great stories. But that's all coming 2022. And then also, we really appreciate reviews. So please go punch that 5-star button on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. Leave a review. Tell us what we're doing wrong or, tell us what we're doing right. Thanks, everybody, and have a good night.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
When you you go out there and the fish are where you think they are, any one of these casts could be the bite. It's the most exciting fishing that I know right here at Hawk's Cave.
Oh, that's awesome.
Experience the best saltwater fishing the world has to offer. Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience, brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts, every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.